Welcome to our series on social capital. My name is Tristan Claridge, and I'm the director of the Institute for Social Capital, and I'm joined by Lyndon Robison, Emeritus Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. Welcome, Lyndon.
Thank you, Tristan. It's always good to see you and have the chance to visit, and hello to all of those who are joining us online.
Lyndon and I have both been working on the concept of social capital for a long time, with Lyndon initially approaching it from economics, whereas I came from sociology and social theory. We're both passionate about the concept, and our different backgrounds and perspectives make for interesting conversations and engaging debates. In this episode, we'll dig deeper into the core of social capital and what relationships mean. It's always talked about, and I think just about everyone agrees that relationships and the ways in which we're connected is really the core of what social capital is all about. So, Lyndon, in a previous episode of our podcast, you made the point that relationships matter. Why do you say that? You know, what's the evidence that relationships matter?
Well, thank you. That's a great question to start our podcast off. And if I can be personal for just a second, when I was in middle school, I didn't have great relationships, and I thought the way to impress girls in my class was to insult them or to do something, you know, very that really did the opposite of build a relationship. And somehow someone related to me or advised me to read Dale Carnegie's book on How to Win Friends and Influence People. And so I read it, and I was struck by what great suggestions he had for building a relationship. And so I applied that, and to some extent, I find my 40 years of research is a lot about rediscovering what Dale Carnegie had to write about. But the point of it is that relationships matter because our well-being depends on them. We can't satisfy our commodity needs or even our social-emotional needs without relationships. And so I think if you just reflected for a moment on how your life is influenced by people with whom you have a relationship, you would say, goodness sakes, nearly everything I do is influenced by relationships.
It's kind of hard to understand what life would be like without relationships. I mean, it's so fundamental to what it means to be human that we're connected with others, that we have social relationships, that we exist within social groupings, and that we interact and exchange with others. It's actually hard to imagine what a human would be like if that weren't the case, because it's so caught up and interconnected in the way that we live our lives. I once read about a baby that was lost somewhere and effectively raised by some wild animals and managed to survive till teenage years and then discovered. And so this was effectively a human who wasn't social, who didn't have social relationships with other humans, who didn't learn language and socialization and enculturation that of course all of us do. And they were virtually unrecognizable as a human. You know, the way in which they acted and the way in which they behaved, you would virtually not describe as human. I think that really illustrates how caught up and interconnected we all are in our social relationships. Like it's impossible to imagine our life without the relationships that we have. And that speaks to just how important relationships are.
Tristan, before earlier today, I just did a quick a search on Google about the importance of relationships. And I mentioned the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, the over 30 million copies sold. Another book on relationships called The Five Love Languages, 20 million copies sold, 50 languages. And then just an incredible long list, Giving the Love You Want by Harvel Hendricks, 2 million. Hold Me Tight by Sue Johnson, 1 million. Seven Principles That Make Marriage Work, 1 million. Influencers, nearly all of the business success deal with relationships if we need evidence that relationships matter. We simply need to look at what people are writing about and reading.
Yeah, that's right. And I think all of us are probably familiar with the titles of those books, even if we haven't purchased them ourselves. So the awareness and the audience of those books is enormous. And it really does, like you said, it really speaks to the importance of relationships, and also perhaps the fact that we appreciate their importance and we want to do better. We want to read a book that helps us to understand relationships and how we can build and strengthen our relationships, perhaps more and better.
I think the next step is, I don't think that anyone would disagree that relationships matter. And I think most people would agree that to some extent, when people talk about social capital, they're really referring to some dimension of a relationship. And when we talk about a relationship, and we say, well, it's how people are connected. Social capital, at least in my understanding, has a very specific connection. And it simply means that if we have a relationship, that we're not independent of each other's well-being. And so when we say social capital, we're referring to relationships that are connected by dependence, that each other's well-being is interdependent.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it. And something that I've become much more aware of from our conversations in recent months is that the term relationships is often a bit ambiguous as to what we actually mean when we're talking about social capital. And certainly for some theories of social capital, relationships means people who know each other. People who have a social relationship with other people who are directly connected through being friends or colleagues or family members or so forth. But what a lot of theories of social capital mean by relationships is what we're talking about now, which is that there's some degree of interconnectedness, there's some degree of commonality that we share with these other people. And it may be that we don't actually know them personally. May not recognize their face. We may not know their name, but we still feel connected to them in some way. So we have a relationship with them. And then what you're saying, digging into, well, what does that relationship actually mean? And I think that idea of interdependence is exactly what it does mean. Is it means that we feel like we're part of them. We're part of their life, their social environment, and therefore the things that happen to them in some way affects us, and the things that have happened to us somehow affects them. And that's what I think we mean by interdependence.
That's how I completely agree with what you're saying. If something good happens to you, then somehow I'm made better off. Or if something unfortunate happens, I'm influenced. Otherwise, we're completely disconnected, and I would say our relationship is mostly transactional. So, and what makes your well-being, what allows me to enables me to internalize your well-being. We've used words like empathy, sympathy, caring, trust, compassion, and so on. And the question is, what would we be like if we didn't, in fact, have social capital that enabled us to internalize each other's well-being? Why, if it doesn't matter, why are we so interested in it? Why are we writing and reading so much? And so can you imagine what life would be like if we didn't internalize each other's well-being?
Well, yeah, it's certainly hard to imagine what it would be like. I think if we take a step back for a moment, we can see that most of the theories of social capital understand it to include factors like social norms or social trust. all these broad social identity, sense of belonging or solidarity. And this is with people who we don't necessarily know. So I think these ideas about social relationship or relationships meaning interconnectedness and connections and the ways in which we're connected, this is consistent with the most theories of social capital, but we haven't, I'm not aware of anyone who's really dug into what that means, and that's what we're doing now. And so the idea of interconnectedness is clearly important. And the way that you just described it, I think, is as internalizing others' well-being. And like when I think about the first time I heard you say that, I thought, yeah, I can understand how that might be relevant. That might be what we're talking about, but it didn't seemed to be quite right to me. I wasn't sure that I really agreed with what you were saying. Like, do I really internalize the well-being of that other person who I'm holding the door open for because it's normatively appropriate to do so, perhaps being the primary reason? And I wasn't sure that I really cared about their well-being, to be honest. And then when I thought about it some more, and so it's following that train of thought that we're talking about now, that it's relationships are the ways in which we're connected, the ways in which we're interdependent, and therefore, of course, the well-being of other people is related to my well-being as well. So therefore, it is about internalizing other people's well-being.
So, the next step, I suppose, to dig deeper into relationship is what is it that makes our relationships that allows us to internalize each other's well-being? And at least in my mind, it means that we're able to produce and exchange something, we've called it relational goods, that satisfy deep social emotional needs and commodity needs for that matter. And so it is in these relationships that we produce these very valuable goods that allow us to satisfy our social emotional needs and to be emotionally healthy people. That if we were to sort of isolate people and deprive them of exchanges of relational goods, I think we would find evidence that we don't do very well, orphans that are neglected and so on.
Right. And I think, like, taking that further, you asked us before, like, what would it be like if we didn't have social capital? What if we couldn't exchange relational goods and meet our social emotional needs? And I think the evidence that we're seeing coming out in recent research is that it results in social isolation, or it results in depression and mental health problems. And I guess not meeting our social emotional needs also then tends to result in not meeting our commodity needs as well. So it's, I think we can understand what it would be like to not have social capital, and it's not good.
I think perhaps if we were to push, maybe dig one step deeper, it would be to sort of identify perhaps certain relational goods, how they're produced, how they're exchanged, the kind of needs they satisfy. For example, I think we have all experienced or experienced vicariously someone performing well, or being recognized with a trophy or a certificate or award or applause or something, and recognize how important external validation is as a form of relational goods that helps us say to ourselves, other people approve of what I'm doing, and I feel it makes me feel better about myself. Or another one would be I'm invited to join or participate in an activity which I share a lot of commonalities with other people, and I had this need to belong that as a result of that particularly relational good, being invited, being included, and so on, I'm better. I just feel better, I feel connected and so on. And then I think we have all had the opportunity of finding someone in distress and responding. I was driving to the store the other day, and and I looked to my right, this elderly woman was on the walking on the street and collapsed. And so I pulled the car over, and immediately about three or four other people joined. And so there were several of us. We checked, helped her establish that she was physically okay, and got her where she needed to go. But it was spontaneous. There was no external reward or penalty. It was just we saw another person in distress, and immediately people who were nearby responded. So what we do is so much more complex than we're simply responding to the need to acquire more commodities.
And that's the example of the interconnectedness that we're talking about. That, clearly there was no existing social relationships there. People who were acting didn't know each other previously. But because of that interdependence, and I guess people's well-being being interdependent, I want to explore that idea of interdependent well-being, that people took action and they got involved. And when you think about what happens is, because you stopped and acted, you felt good and you received relational goods or whatever you want to think about it, it was a good outcome for you. It was a positive experience and something that you would, I'm sure, do again. She also felt good because someone stopped to assist, and obviously there was other benefits there as well. So although as a I'm not an economist, and we've talked about language before, that we use different language, and but it's an exchange. I can understand it as an exchange of relational goods, that you felt good and she felt good, and good things occurred as a result of these actions that took place. And that does represent internalizing other people's well-being because of that interdependence that we experienced with people who you didn't know, with effectively with strangers, but you still felt connected with and had that relationship with in terms of the ways in which we connected. And I'd be interested what that the nature of that connection was. It may have been simply that you're both members of the same community or same society or whatever the reasons that you feel connected you. And there could be various reasons why you felt connected.
One, there is a relationship that perhaps we could mention, and that is our relationship with our ideal self that has been formed by the examples of others, reinforcements in the past, our culture, perhaps. But nevertheless, at least I think I have defined in my mind or whatever, wherever it's defined, of what right behavior is as a person, as a member of, as a human. And that person says, if you see someone in distress, you should act. Now, maybe in other communities, you would say, well, that is a very dangerous action. There could be lawsuits and so on. But I think we all kind of define for ourselves what is self-validating behavior. And when possible, and of course there are conflicts, we try and act to win the approval of our ideal self. Some people might call that a conscience, but nevertheless, we do try and win internal validation when possible.
And I think a lot of people would talk about this as being our actions aligning with our values, or perhaps our moral values, and what we think is right and wrong to do in a particular situation. But I think this still does come down to the way in which we're connected, because the way in which we define our values is largely socially defined. Like you made the point that in a particular society or community, it may not be appropriate to stop and act, and part of the reason may be because you might get into legal trouble if you did and did the wrong thing or something. So the value system is quite extensively defined by our social grouping and the way in which we're connected to others. So I think these are the core points of what social capital is about, is this idea of relationships. And what we mean by relationships really is the ways in which we're connected and interconnected and interdependent on other people in our social groupings.
Agreed, very much so. Tristan, you and I had a conversation on your podcast some time ago about looking at relationships perhaps in a more complicated way, looking at triads as opposed to binary relationships. And so when we think about social capital, while it's often more convenient and easier to describe in one-on-one relationships, most of our, or a lot of mine, experiences at least involve more than one relationship simultaneously. As a parent raising children and trying to be a peacemaker or a broker, and feeling the pressures of social capital relationships, or in more complicated, where you have asymmetric relationships, there's a lot to be learned about how we manage social capital in more complex social settings.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's the idea, I think, as well, that we're always part of multiple social groupings at the same time. We might be part of our family, but also part of our neighborhood, but also part of our particular business or employment environment and potentially other interest groups and so forth. And these don't always align in terms of the nature of those connections, the nature of that connectedness don't always align. We might have certain feelings and beliefs and attitudes towards our family members, but they may also be members of an organization, and so you end up with different and complex kinds of relationships going on. I think that's taking it a little further than what you were just talking about in terms of triads, but it's the same kind of idea that any one relationship or any one form of connection doesn't exist in isolation from the other connections that exist around you.
And we, where those more complex relationships become evident is in international relationships, where you have country A wanting to maintain a relationship with country B, and B wanting to maintain a relationship with C, but then countries A and C don't like each other or fighting. For example, you can think of China and Russia and the United States, or Hungary and Russia and the European Union. You just don't have to look very far to see sort of complicated relationships that involve social capital, but they involve more than two players.
Yeah, and it also speaks to the interdependence that we've been talking about in this episode as well, that the consideration of different countries to try to negotiate and accommodate other countries' needs speaks to the interdependence that we all have. In international diplomacy, you can't treat one relationship in isolation from the other interdependent relationships that exist with other countries. So it speaks to what we really mean by relationships being that interconnected and interdependent nature.
Absolutely. And so wherever we see a conflict, we can see some party in the current situation in Gaza and Israel, parties that are trying to use, perhaps the United States, trying to use its goodwill with hopefully Gaza and Israel to bring about some kind of moderated outcome. But these roles of brokers and peacemakers are how we effectively try to use our social capital, where you have a party that has influence, has a relationship with two conflicting or separated parties to bring them together. And so there is a role, I think, for social capital in multiple spheres, but one of them would be in the policy arena of how we can use our social capital to reduce conflicts.
Yeah, I agree. I think we need to dedicate an episode in the near future to this topic to explore it in a bit more detail. But we've run out of time for this one. I think it was really worthwhile to reconnect and dig a bit deeper into the idea of relationships and the core of what social capital is all about. So as always, Lyndon, it's been great talking with you, and I look forward to the next one.
Equally, Tristan, good to see you, and thank you to all those that have joined us online. We look forward to another episode.